Chapter 12.
"So, you've turned up again like a bad penny," said Miss Ramsbottom.
Lance grinned at her.
"Just as you say, Aunt Effie."
"Humph," Miss Ramsbottom sniffed disapprovingly. "You've chosen a nice time to do it. Your father got himself murdered yesterday. The house is full of police poking about everywhere, grubbing in the dustbins even. I've seen them out of the window."
She paused, sniffed again, and asked,
"Got your wife with you?"
"No, I left Pat in London."
"That shows some sense. I shouldn't bring her here if I were you. You never know what might happen."
"To her? To Pat?"
"To anybody," said Miss Ramsbottom.
Lance Fortescue looked at her thoughtfully.
"Got any ideas about it all, Aunt Effie?" he asked.
Miss Ramsbottom did not reply directly.
"I had an inspector here yesterday asking me questions. He didn't get much change out of me, but he wasn't such a fool as he looked, not by a long way."
She added with some indignation,
"What your grandfather would feel if he knew we had the police in the house. It's enough to make him turn in his grave. A strict Plymouth Brother he was, all his life. The fuss there was when he found out I'd been attending Church of England services in the evening, and I'm sure that was harmless enough compared to murder."
Normally Lance would have smiled at this, but his long, dark face remained serious. He said,
"Do you know, I'm quite in the dark, after having been away so long. What's been going on here of late?"
Miss Ramsbottom raised her eyes to heaven.
"Godless doings," she said firmly.
"Yes, yes, Aunt Effie, you would say that anyway. But what gives the police the idea that Dad was killed here, in this house?"
"Adultery is one thing and murder is another," said Miss Ramsbottom. "I shouldn't like to think it of her. I shouldn't indeed."
Lance looked alert. "Adele?" he asked.
"My lips are sealed," said Miss Ramsbottom.
"Come on, old dear," said Lance. "It's a lovely phrase, but it doesn't mean a thing. Adele had a boyfriend. Adele and the boyfriend fed him henbane in the morning tea. Is that the set-up?"
"I'll trouble you not to joke about it."
"Well, I wasn't really joking, you know."
"I'll tell you one thing," said Miss Ramsbottom suddenly. "I believe that girl knows something about it."
"Which girl?"
Lance looked surprised.
"The one that sniffs," said Miss Ramsbottom. "The one that ought to have brought me up my tea this afternoon, but didn't. Gone out without leave, so they say. Well, shouldn't wonder if she'd gone to the police. Who let you in?"
"Someone called Mary Dove, I understand. Very meek and mild, but not really. Is she the one who's gone to the police?"
"She wouldn't go to the police," said Miss Ramsbottom. "No, I mean that silly little parlour maid. She's been twitching and jumping like a rabbit all day. 'What's the matter with you?' I said. 'Have you got a guilty conscience?' She said, 'I never did anything. I wouldn't do a thing like that.' 'I hope you wouldn't,' I said to her. 'But there's something worrying you now, isn't there?' Then she began to sniff and said she didn't want to get anybody into trouble. She was sure it must be all a mistake. I said to her, I said, 'Now, my girl, you speak the truth and shame the devil.' That's what I said. 'You go to the police,' I said, 'and tell them anything you know, because no good ever came,' I said, 'of hushing up the truth, however unpleasant it is.' Then she talked a lot of nonsense about how she couldn't go to the police. They'd never believe her, and what on earth should she say? She ended up by saying, anyway, she didn't know anything at all."
"You don't think," Lance hesitated, "that she was just making herself important?"
"No, I don't. I think she was scared. I think she saw something or heard something that's given her some idea about the whole thing. It may be important, or it mayn't be of the least consequence."
"You don't think she herself could have had a grudge against Father and—"
Lance hesitated. Miss Ramsbottom was shaking her head decidedly.
"She's not the kind of girl your father would have taken the least notice of. No man ever will take much notice of her, poor girl. Ah, well, it's all the better for her soul, that, I dare say."
Lance took no interest in Gladys's soul. He asked, "You think she may have run along to the police station?" Aunt Effie nodded vigorously.
"Yes! I think she mayn't have liked to have said anything to them in this house in case somebody overheard her."
Lance asked, "Do you think she may have seen someone tampering with the food?" Aunt Effie threw him a sharp glance.
"It's possible, isn't it?" she said.
"Yes, I suppose so." Then he added apologetically, "The whole thing still seems so wildly improbable, like a detective story."
"Percival's wife is a hospital nurse," said Miss Ramsbottom.
The remark seemed so unconnected with what had gone before that Lance looked at her in a puzzled fashion.
"Hospital nurses are used to handling drugs," said Miss Ramsbottom.
Lance looked doubtful.
"This stuff, taxine, is it ever used in medicine?"
"They get it from yew berries, I gather. Children eat yew berries sometimes," said Miss Ramsbottom. "Makes them very ill, too. I remember a case when I was a child. It made a great impression on me. I never forgot it. Things you remember come in useful sometimes."
Lance raised his head sharply and stared at her.
"Natural affection is one thing," said Miss Ramsbottom, "and I hope I've got as much of it as anyone. But I won't stand for wickedness. Wickedness has to be destroyed."
"Went off without a word to me," said Mrs. Crump, raising her red, wrathful face from the pastry she was now rolling out on the board. "Slipped out without a word to anybody. Sly, that's what it is. Sly. Afraid she'd be stopped. And I would have stopped her if I'd caught her. The idea. There's the master dead, Mr. Lance coming home that hasn't been home for years, and I said to Crump, I said, day out or no day out, I know my duty. There's not going to be cold supper tonight, as is usual on a Thursday, but a proper dinner. A gentleman coming home from abroad with his wife, what was formerly married in the aristocracy. Things must be properly done. You know me, miss. You know I take a pride in my work."
Mary Dove, the recipient of these confidences, nodded her head gently.
"And what does Crump say?"
Mrs. Crump's voice rose angrily.
"It's my day off, and I'm going off. That's what he says. And a fig for the aristocracy," he says. No pride in his work, Crump hasn't. So off he goes, and I tell Gladys she'll have to manage alone tonight. She just says, "All right, Mrs. Crump." Then, when my back's turned, out she sneaks. It wasn't her day out anyway. Friday's her day. How we're going to manage now, I don't know. Thank goodness Mr. Lance hasn't brought his wife here with him today.
We shall manage, Mrs. Crump. Mary's voice was both soothing and authoritative. If we just simplify the menu a little. She outlined a few suggestions. Mrs. Crump nodded unwilling acquiescence. "I shall be able to serve that quite easily," Mary concluded.
"You mean you'll wait at table yourself, miss?"
Mrs. Crump sounded doubtful. "If Gladys doesn't come back in time."
"She won't come back," said Mrs. Crump. "Gallivanting off, wasting her money somewhere in the shops. She's got a young man, you know, miss, though you wouldn't think it to look at her. Albert, his name is. Going to get married next spring, so she tells me. Don't know what the married state's like, these girls don't. What I've been through with Crump."
She sighed, then said in an ordinary voice,
"What about tea, miss? Who's going to clear it away and wash it up?"
"I'll do that," said Mary. "I'll go and do it now." The lights had not been turned on in the library, though Adele Fortescue was still sitting on the sofa behind the tea tray.
"Shall I switch the lights on, Mrs. Fortescue?" Mary asked.
Adele did not answer. Mary switched on the lights and went across to the window where she pulled the curtains across. It was only then that she turned her head and saw the face of the woman who had sagged back against the cushions. A half-eaten scone spread with honey was beside her, and her teacup was still half full. Death had come to Adele Fortescue, suddenly and swiftly. Well? Demanded Inspector Neil impatiently. The doctor said promptly, Cyanide. Potassium cyanide, probably, in the tea.
Cyanide, muttered Neil.
The doctor looked at him with slight curiosity. You're taking this hard. Any special reason?
She was cast as a murderess, said Neil.
And she turns out to be a victim. You'll have to think again, won't you?
Neil nodded. His face was bitter, and his jaw was grimly set. Poisoned, right under his nose. Taxine in Rex Fortescue's breakfast coffee. Cyanide in Adele Fortescue's tea. Still an intimate family affair, or so it seemed. Adele Fortescue, Jennifer Fortescue, Elaine Fortescue, and the newly arrived Lance Fortescue had had tea together in the library. Lance had gone up to see Miss Ramsbottom. Jennifer had gone to her own sitting room to write letters. Elaine had been the last to leave the library. According to her, Adele had then been in perfect health and had just been pouring herself out a last cup of tea.
A last cup of tea? Yes, it had indeed been her last cup of tea.
And after that, a blank 20 minutes, perhaps, until Mary Dove had come into the room and discovered the body. And during that 20 minutes...
Inspector Neil swore to himself and went out into the kitchen. Sitting in a chair by the kitchen table, the vast figure of Mrs. Crump, her belligerence pricked like a balloon, hardly stirred as he came in.
"Where's that girl? Has she come back yet?"
"Gladys? No, she's not back. Won't be, I suspect, until 11 o'clock."
"She made the tea, you say, and took it in?"
"I didn't touch it, sir, as God's my witness. And what's more, I don't believe Gladys did anything she shouldn't. She wouldn't do a thing like that. Not Gladys. She's a good enough girl, sir. A bit foolish-like, that's all. Not wicked."
No, Neil did not think that Gladys was wicked. He did not think that Gladys was a poisoner. And, in any case, the cyanide had not been in the teapot. But what made her go off suddenly like this? It wasn't her day out, you say?
No, sir. Tomorrow's her day out.
Does Crump... Mrs. Crump's belligerence suddenly revived. Her voice rose wrathfully.
"Don't you go fastening anything on Crump! Crump's out of it! He went off at 3 o'clock, and thankful I am now that he did. He's as much out of it as Mr. Percival himself."
Percival Fortescue had only just returned from London to be greeted by the astounding news of this second tragedy.
"I wasn't accusing Crump," said Neil mildly. "I just wondered if he knew anything about Gladys's plans."
"She had her best nylons on," said Mrs. Crump. "She was up to something, don't tell me. Didn't cut any sandwiches for tea, either. Oh, yes, she was up to something. I'll give her a piece of my mind when she comes back."
When she comes back? A faint uneasiness possessed Neil. To shake it off, he went upstairs to Adele Fortescue's bedroom. A lavish apartment, all rose brocade hangings and a vast gilt bed. On one side of the room was a door into a mirror-lined bathroom with a sunken orchid-pink porcelain bath. Beyond the bathroom, reached by a communicating door, was Rex Fortescue's room. Neil went back into Adele's bedroom and through the door on the farther side of the room into her sitting room. The room was furnished in Empire style, with a rose-pile carpet. Neil only gave it a cursory glance, for that particular room had had his close attention on the preceding day, with special attention paid to the small, elegant desk. Now, however, he stiffened to sudden attention. On the centre of the rose-pile carpet was a small piece of caked mud. Neil went over to it and picked it up. The mud was still damp. He looked round. There were no footprints visible, only this one isolated fragment of wet earth. Inspector Neil looked round the bedroom that belonged to Gladys Martin. It was past 11 o'clock. Crump had come in half an hour ago,
but there was still no sign of Gladys. Inspector Neil looked round him. Whatever Gladys's training had been, her own natural instincts were slovenly. The bed, Inspector Neil judged, was seldom made, the windows seldom opened. Gladys's personal habits, however, were not his immediate concern. Instead, he went carefully through her possessions. They consisted, for the most part, of cheap and rather pathetic finery. There was little that was durable or of good quality. The elderly Ellen, whom he had called upon to assist him, had not been helpful. She didn't know what clothes Gladys had or hadn't. She couldn't say what, if anything, was missing. He turned from the clothes and the underclothes to the contents of the chest of drawers. There Gladys kept her treasures. There were picture postcards and newspaper cuttings, knitting patterns, hints on beauty culture, dressmaking and fashion advice. Inspector Neil sorted them neatly into various categories. The picture postcards consisted mainly of views of various places where he presumed Gladys had spent her holidays. Among them were three picture postcards signed Bert. Bert he took to be the young man referred to by Mrs. Crump. The first postcard said, in an illiterate hand, "All the best, missing you a lot, yours ever, Bert." The second said, "Lots of nice-looking girls here, but not one that's a patch on you. Be seeing you soon. Don't forget our date. And remember, after that, it's thumbs up and living happy ever after." The third said merely, "Don't forget. I'm trusting you. Love, B." Next, Neil looked through the newspaper cuttings and sorted them into three piles. There were the dressmaking and beauty hints. There were items about cinema stars, to which Gladys had appeared greatly addicted. And she had also, it appeared, been attracted by the latest marvels of science. There were cuttings about flying saucers, about secret weapons, about truth drugs used by Russians, and claims for fantastic drugs discovered by American doctors. All the witchcraft, so Neil thought, of our 20th century. But in all the contents of the room there was nothing to give him a clue to her disappearance. She had kept no diary, not that he had expected that. It was a remote possibility. There was no unfinished letter, no record at all of anything she might have seen in the house which could have had a bearing on Rex Fortescue's death. Whatever Gladys had seen, whatever Gladys had known, there was no record of it. It would still have to be guesswork why the second tea tray had been left in the hall and Gladys herself had so suddenly vanished. Sighing, Neil left the room, shutting the door behind him. As he prepared to descend the small winding stairs, he heard a noise of running feet coming along the landing below. The agitated face of Sergeant Hay looked up at him from the bottom of the stairs. Sergeant Hay was panting a little. "Sir," he said urgently, "sir, we found her."
"Found her?"
"It was the housemaid, sir, Ellen. Remembered as she hadn't brought the clothes in from where they were hanging on the line, just round the corner from the back door. So she went out with a torch to take them in, and she almost fell over the body. The girl's body. Strangled, she was, with a stocking round her throat. Been dead for hours, I'd say. And, sir, it's a wicked kind of joke. There was a clothes peg clipped on her nose."
Chapter 13. An elderly lady travelling by train had bought three morning papers, and each of them, as she finished it, folded it and laid it aside, showed the same headline. It was no longer a question now of a small paragraph hidden away in the corner of the papers. There were headlines with flaring announcements of triple tragedy at Yew Tree Lodge. The old lady sat very upright, looking out of the window of the train, her lips pursed together, an expression of distress and disapproval on her pink and white wrinkled face. Miss Marple, had left St. Mary Mead by the early train, changing at the junction and going on to London, where she took a circle train to another London terminus, and thence on to Baden Heath. At the station, she signalled a taxi and asked to be taken to Yew Tree Lodge. So charming, so innocent, such a fluffy and pink-and-white old lady was Miss Marple, that she gained admittance to what was now practically a fortress in a state of siege far more easily than could have been believed possible. Though an army of reporters and photographers was being kept at bay by the police, Miss Marple was allowed to drive in without question. So impossible would it have been to believe that she was anyone but an elderly relative of the family. Miss Marple paid off the taxi in a careful assortment of small change and rang the front doorbell. Crump opened it, and Miss Marple summed him up with an experienced glance. "A shifty eye," she said to herself. "Scared to death, too." Crump saw a tall, elderly lady wearing an old-fashioned tweed coat and skirt, a couple of scarves, and a small felt hat with a bird's wing. The old lady carried a capacious handbag, and an aged but good-quality suitcase reposed by her feet. Crump recognised a lady when he saw one, and said, "Yes, madam," in his best and most respectful voice. "Could I see the mistress of the house, please?" said Miss Marple. Crump drew back to let her in. He picked up the suitcase and put it carefully down in the hall. "Well, madam," he said rather dubiously, "I don't know who exactly..." Miss Marple helped him out. "I have come," she said, "to speak about the poor girl who was killed, Gladys Martin."
"Oh, I see, madam. Well, in that case..."
He broke off and looked towards the library door, from which a tall young woman had just emerged.
"This is Mrs. Lance Fortescue, madam," he said.
Pat came forward, and she and Miss Marple looked at each other. Miss Marple was aware of a faint feeling of surprise. She had not expected to see someone like Patricia Fortescue in this particular house. Its interior was much as she had pictured it, but Pat did not somehow match with that interior.
"It's about Gladys, madam," said Crump helpfully.
Pat said rather hesitatingly, "Will you come in here? We shall be quite alone." She led the way into the library, and Miss Marple followed her. "There wasn't anyone specially you wanted to see, was there?" said Pat. "Because perhaps I shan't be much good. You see, my husband and I only came back from Africa a few days ago. We don't really know anything much about the household. But I can fetch my sister-in-law or my brother-in-law's wife." Miss Marple looked at the girl and liked her. She liked her gravity and her simplicity. For some strange reason, she felt sorry for her. A background of shabby chintz and horses and dogs, Miss Marple felt vaguely, would have been much more suitable than this richly furnished interior decor. At the pony show and gymkhanas held locally round St. Mary Mead, Miss Marple had met many Pats and knew them well. She felt at home with this rather unhappy-looking girl. "It's very simple, really," said Miss Marple, taking off her gloves carefully and smoothing out the fingers of them. "I read in the paper, you see, about Gladys Martin having been killed, and, of course, I know all about her. She comes from my part of the country. I trained her, in fact, for domestic service. And since this terrible thing has happened to her, I felt that I ought to come and see if there was anything I could do about it." "Yes," said Pat. "Of course, I see." And she did see. Miss Marple's action appeared to her natural and inevitable. "I think it's a very good thing you have come," said Pat. "Nobody seems to know very much about her. I mean, relations and all that." "No," said Miss Marple. "Of course not. She hadn't got any relations. She came to me from the orphanage, St. Faith's, a very well-run place, though sadly short of funds. We do our best for the girls there, try to give them a good training and all that. Gladys came to me when she was 17, and I taught her how to wait at table and keep the silver and everything like that. Of course, she didn't stay long. They never do. As soon as she got a little experience, she went and took a job in a cafe. The girls nearly always want to do that. They think it's freer, you know, and a gayer life. Perhaps it may be. I really don't know.
I never even saw her, said Pat.
Was she a pretty girl?
Oh, no, said Miss Marple. Not at all. Adenoids and a good many spots. She was rather pathetically stupid, too. I don't suppose, went on Miss Marple thoughtfully, that she ever made many friends anywhere. She was very keen on men, poor girl, but men didn't take much notice of her, and other girls rather made use of her.
It sounds rather cruel, said Pat.
Yes, my dear, said Miss Marple. Life is cruel, I'm afraid. One doesn't really know what to do with the Gladyses. They enjoy going to the pictures and all that, but they're always thinking of impossible things that can't possibly happen to them. Perhaps that's happiness of a kind, but they get disappointed. I think Gladys was disappointed in cafe and restaurant life. Nothing very glamorous or interesting happened to her, and it was just hard on the feet. Probably that's why she came back into private service. Do you know how long she'd been here?
Pat shook her head.
Not very long, I should think. Only a month or two.
Pat paused and then went on.
It seems so horrible and futile that she should have been caught up in this thing. I suppose she'd seen something or noticed something.
It was the clothes peg that really worried me, said Miss Marple in her gentle voice.
The clothes peg? Yes, I read about it in the papers. I suppose it is true that when she was found, there was a clothes peg clipped onto her nose.
Pat nodded. The colour rose to Miss Marple's pink cheeks.
That's what made me so very angry, if you can understand, my dear. It was such a cruel, contemptuous gesture. It gave me a kind of picture of the murderer. To do a thing like that, it's very wicked, you know, to affront human dignity, particularly if you've already killed.
Pat said slowly,
I think I see what you mean.
She got up.
I think you'd better come and see Inspector Neil. He's in charge of the case, and he's here now. You'll like him, I think. He's a very human person.
She gave a sudden, quick shiver.
The whole thing is such a horrible nightmare. Pointless. Mad. Without rhyme or reason in it.
I wouldn't say that, you know, said Miss Marple.
No, I wouldn't say that.
Inspector Neil was looking tired and haggard. Three deaths, and the press of the whole country whooping down the trail. A case that seemed to be shaping in well-known fashion had gone suddenly haywire. Adele Fortescue, the appropriate suspect, was now the second victim of an incomprehensible murder case. At the close of that fatal day, the Assistant Commissioner had sent for Neil, and the two men had talked far into the night. In spite of his dismay, or rather behind it, Inspector Neil had felt a faint inward satisfaction. That pattern of the wife and the lover, it had been too slick, too easy. He had always mistrusted it, and now that mistrust of his was justified.
The whole thing takes on an entirely different aspect, the A.C. had said, striding up and down his room and frowning. It looks to me, Neil, as though we'd got someone mentally unhinged to deal with. First the husband, then the wife. But the very circumstances of the case seem to show that it's an inside job. It's all there in the family. Someone who sat down to breakfast with Fortescue put taxine in his coffee or on his food. Someone who had tea with the family that day put potassium cyanide in Adele Fortescue's cup of tea. Someone trusted, unnoticed, one of the family. Which of 'em, Neil?
Neil said dryly. Percival wasn't there, so that lets him out again. That lets him out again, Inspector Neil repeated. The AC looked at him sharply. Something in the repetition had attracted his attention.
What's the idea, Neil? Out with it, man.
Inspector Neil looked stolid.
Nothing, sir. Not so much as an idea.
All I say is it was very convenient for him.
A bit too convenient, eh?
The AC reflected and shook his head.
You think he might have managed it somehow? Can't see how, Neil. No, I can't see how, he added. And he's a cautious type, too.
But quite intelligent, sir.
You don't fancy the women, is that it? Yet the women are indicated. Elaine Fortescue and Percival's wife. They were at breakfast and they were at tea that day. Either of them could have done it. No signs of anything abnormal about them? Well, it doesn't always show. There might be something in their past medical record.
Inspector Neil did not answer. He was thinking of Mary Dove. He had no definite reason for suspecting her, but that was the way his thoughts lay. There was something unexplained about her, unsatisfactory, a faint, amused antagonism. That had been her attitude after the death of Rex Fortescue. What was her attitude now? Her behaviour and manner were, as always, exemplary. There was no longer, he thought, amusement. Perhaps not even antagonism. But he wondered whether, once or twice, he had not seen a trace of fear. He had been to blame, culpably to blame, in the matter of Gladys Martin. That slight guilty confusion of hers he had put down to no more than a natural nervousness of the police. He had come across that guilty nervousness so often. In this case, it had been something more. Gladys had seen or heard something which had aroused her suspicions. It was probably, he thought, some quite small thing, something so vague and indefinite that she had hardly liked to speak about it. And now, poor little rabbit, she would never speak. Inspector Neil looked with some interest at the mild, earnest face of the old lady who confronted him now at Yew Tree Lodge. He had been in two minds at first how to treat her, but he quickly made up his mind. Miss Marple would be useful to him. She was upright, of unimpeachable rectitude, and she had, like most old ladies, time on her hands and an old maid's nose for scenting bits of gossip. She'd get things out of servants and out of the women of the Fortescue family, perhaps, that he and his policeman would never get. Talk, conjecture, reminiscences, repetitions of things said and done. Out of them all, she would pick the salient facts. So, Inspector Neil was gracious. "It's uncommonly good of you to have come here, Miss Marple," he said.
"It was my duty, Inspector Neil. The girl had lived in my house. I feel, in a sense, responsible for her. She was a very silly girl, you know."
Inspector Neil looked at her appreciatively. "Yes," he said, "just so."
She had gone, he felt, to the heart of the matter. "She wouldn't know," said Miss Marple, "what she ought to do. If, I mean, something came up. Oh, dear, I'm expressing myself very badly."
Inspector Neil said that he understood. "She hadn't got good judgment as to what was important or not. That's what you mean, isn't it?"
"Oh, yes, exactly, Inspector."
"When you say she was silly..." Inspector Neil broke off. Miss Marple took up the theme.
"She was the credulous type. She was the sort of girl who would have given her savings to a swindler, if she'd had any savings. Of course, she never did have any savings, because she always spent her money on most unsuitable clothes."
"What about men?" asked the inspector.
"She wanted a young man badly," said Miss Marple. "In fact, that's really, I think, why she left St. Mary Mead. The competition there is very keen. So few men. She did have hopes of the young man who delivered the fish. Young Fred had a pleasant word for all the girls, but of course he didn't mean anything by it. That upset poor Gladys quite a lot. Still, I gather she did get herself a young man in the end. Inspector Neil nodded.
It seems so. Albert Evans, I gather his name was. She seems to have met him at some holiday camp. He didn't give her a ring or anything, so maybe she made it all up. He was a mining engineer, so she told the cook.
That seems most unlikely, said Miss Marple, but I dare say it's what he told her. As I say, she'd believe anything. You don't connect him with this business at all?
Inspector Neil shook his head. No, I don't think there are any complications of that kind. He never seems to have visited her. He sent her a postcard from time to time, usually from a seaport, probably fourth engineer on a boat on the Baltic run.
Well, said Miss Marple, I'm glad she had her little romance, since her life has been cut short in this way.
She tightened her lips.
You know, Inspector, it makes me very, very angry.
And she added, as she had said to Pat Fortescue,
especially the clothes peg. That, Inspector, was really wicked.
Inspector Neil looked at her with interest. I know just what you mean, Miss Marple, he said.
Miss Marple coughed apologetically. I wonder, I suppose it would be great presumption on my part, if only I could assist you in my very humble, and I'm afraid very feminine way. This is a wicked murderer, Inspector Neil, and the wicked should not go unpunished.
That's an unfashionable belief nowadays, Miss Marple, Inspector Neil said rather grimly. Not that I don't agree with you.
There is a hotel near the station, or there's the Golf Hotel, said Miss Marple tentatively, and I believe there's a Miss Ramsbottom in this house who is interested in foreign missions.
Inspector Neil looked at Miss Marple appraisingly. Yes, he said. You've got something there, maybe. I can't say that I've had great success with the lady.
It's really very kind of you, Inspector Neil, said Miss Marple. I'm so glad you don't think I'm just a sensation hunter.
Inspector Neil gave a sudden, rather unexpected smile. He was thinking to himself that Miss Marple was very unlike the popular idea of an avenging fury, and yet he thought that was perhaps exactly what she was.
Newspapers, said Miss Marple, are often so sensational in their accounts, but hardly, I fear, as accurate as one might wish.
She looked inquiringly at Inspector Neil.
If one could be sure of having just the sober facts?
They're not particularly sober, said Neil. Shorn of undue sensation, they're as follows. Mr. Fortescue died in his office as a result of taxine poisoning. Taxine is obtained from the berries and leaves of yew trees.
Very convenient, Miss Marple said.
Possibly, said Inspector Neil, but we've no evidence as to that. As yet, that is.
He stressed the point because it was here that he thought Miss Marple might be useful.
If any brew or concoction of yew berries had been made in the house, Miss Marple was quite likely to come upon traces of it. She was the sort of old pussy who would make homemade liquors, cordials, and herb teas herself. She would know methods of making and methods of disposal.
And Mrs. Fortescue?
Mrs. Fortescue had tea with the family in the library. The last person to leave the room and the tea table was Miss Elaine Fortescue, her stepdaughter. She states that as she left the room, Mrs. Fortescue was pouring herself out another cup of tea. Some 20 minutes or half hour later, Miss Dove, who acts as housekeeper, went in to remove the tea tray. Mrs. Fortescue was still sitting on the sofa, dead. Beside her was a teacup, a quarter full, and in the dregs of it was potassium cyanide.
Which is almost immediate in its action, I believe, said Miss Marple.
Exactly.
Such dangerous stuff, murmured Miss Marple. One has it,
to take wasps' nests, but I'm always very, very careful.
You're quite right, said Inspector Neil. There was a packet of it in the gardener's shed here.
Again, very convenient, said Miss Marple. She added, was Mrs. Fortescue eating anything?
Oh, yes, they'd had tea.
Cake, I suppose, bread and butter, scones, perhaps, jam, honey.
Yes, there were honey and scones, chocolate cake and Swiss roll, and various other plates of things.
He looked at her curiously.
The potassium cyanide was in the tea, Miss Marple.
Oh, yes, yes, I quite understand that. I was just getting the whole picture, so to speak. Rather significant, don't you think?
He looked at her in a slightly puzzled fashion. Her cheeks were pink, her eyes were bright.
And the third death, Inspector Neil?
Well, the facts there seem clear enough, too. The girl Gladys took in the tea tray. Then she brought the next tray into the hall, but left it there. She'd been rather absent-minded all the day, apparently. After that, no one saw her. The cook, Mrs. Crump, jumped to the conclusion that the girl had gone out without telling anybody. She based her belief, I think, on the fact that the girl was wearing a good pair of nylon stockings and her best shoes. There, however, she was proved quite wrong. The girl had obviously remembered suddenly that she'd not taken in some clothes that were drying outside on the clothesline. She ran out to fetch them in, had taken down half of them, apparently, when somebody took her unawares by slipping a stocking round her neck, and, well, that was that.
"Someone from outside?" said Miss Marple.
"Perhaps," said Inspector Neil. "But perhaps someone from inside. Someone who'd been waiting his or her opportunity to get the girl alone. The girl was upset, nervous, when we first questioned her, but I'm afraid we didn't quite appreciate the importance of that."
"Oh, but how could you?" cried Miss Marple. "People so often do look guilty and embarrassed when they are questioned by the police."
"That's just it. But this time, Miss Marple, it was rather more than that. I think the girl Gladys had seen someone performing some action that seemed to her needed explanation. It can't, I think, have been anything very definite, otherwise she would have spoken out. But I think she did betray the fact to the person in question. That person realised that Gladys was a danger."
"And so Gladys was strangled and a clothes peg clipped on her nose," murmured Miss Marple to herself.
"Yes, that's a nasty touch. A nasty, sneering sort of touch. Just a nasty bit of unnecessary bravado."
Miss Marple shook her head. "Hardly unnecessary. It does all make a pattern, doesn't it?" Inspector Neil looked at her curiously.
"I don't quite follow you, Miss Marple. What do you mean by a pattern?"
Miss Marple immediately became flustered. "Well, I mean, it does seem, I mean, regarded as a sequence, if you understand. Well, one can't get away from facts, can one?"
"I don't think I quite understand."
"Well, I mean, first we have Mr. Fortescue, Rex Fortescue, killed in his office in the city. And then we have Mrs. Fortescue sitting here in the library and having tea. There were scones and honey. And then poor Gladys with the clothes peg on her nose, just to point the whole thing. That very charming Mrs. Lance Fortescue said to me that there didn't seem to be any rhyme or reason in it, but I couldn't agree with her, because it's the rhyme that strikes one, isn't it?"
Inspector Neil said slowly, "I don't think..."
Miss Marple went on quickly. "I expect you're about 35 or 36, aren't you, Inspector Neil? I think there was rather a reaction just then, when you were a little boy, I mean, against nursery rhymes. But if one has been brought up on Mother Goose, I mean, it is really highly significant, isn't it? What I wondered was..." Miss Marple paused, then, appearing to take her courage in her hands, went on bravely, "Of
course, it is great impertinence, I know, on my part, saying this sort of thing to you.
Please, say anything you like, Miss Marple.
Well, that's very kind of you. I shall. Though, as I say, I do it with the utmost diffidence, because I know I am very old and rather muddle-headed, and I dare say my idea is of no value at all. But what I mean to say is, have you gone into the question of blackbirds?
Chapter 14.
For about 10 seconds, Inspector Neil stared at Miss Marple with the utmost bewilderment. His first idea was that the old lady had gone off her head.
Blackbirds, he repeated.
Miss Marple nodded her head vigorously.
Yes, she said, and forthwith recited. Sing a song of sixpence, a pocket full of rye, 24 blackbirds baked in a pie. When the pie was opened, the birds began to sing. Wasn't that a dainty dish to set before the king? The king was in his counting-house, counting out his money. The queen was in the parlour, eating bread and honey. The maid was in the garden, hanging out the clothes, when there came a little dicky bird and nipped off her nose.
Good Lord, Inspector Neil said.
I mean, it does fit, said Miss Marple. It was rye in his pocket, wasn't it? One newspaper said so. The others just said cereal, which might mean anything, farmer's glory or cornflakes or even maize, but it was rye.
Inspector Neil nodded.
There you are, said Miss Marple triumphantly. Rex Fortescue. Rex means king, in his counting house. And Mrs. Fortescue, the queen, in the parlour, eating bread and honey. And so, of course, the murderer had to put that clothes peg on poor Gladys's nose.
Inspector Neil said, You mean the whole set-up is crazy?
Well, one mustn't jump to conclusions, but it is certainly very odd. But you really must make inquiries about blackbirds, because there must be blackbirds.
It was at this point that Sergeant Hay came into the room, saying urgently,
Sir!
He broke off at the sight of Miss Marple. Inspector Neil, recovering himself, said,
Thank you, Miss Marple. I'll look into the matter. Since you are interested in the girl, perhaps you would care to look over the things from her room. Sergeant Hay will show you them presently.
Miss Marple, accepting her dismissal, twittered her way out.
Blackbirds, murmured Inspector Neil to himself.
Sergeant Hay stared.
Yes, Hay, what is it?
Sir,
said Sergeant Hay urgently again, look at this.
He produced an article wrapped in a somewhat grubby handkerchief.
Found it in the shrubbery, said Sergeant Hay. Could have been chucked there from one of the back windows.
He tipped the object down on the desk in front of the inspector, who leaned forward and inspected it with rising excitement. The exhibit was a nearly full pot of marmalade. The inspector stared at it without speech. His face assumed a peculiarly wooden and stupid appearance. In actual fact, this meant that Inspector Neil's mind was racing once more round an imaginary track. A moving picture was enacting itself before the eyes of his mind. He saw a new pot of marmalade. He saw hands carefully removing its cover. He saw a small quantity of marmalade removed, mixed with a preparation of taxine, and replaced in the pot, the top smoothed over and the lid carefully replaced. He broke off at this point to ask Sergeant Hay,
They don't take marmalade out of the pot and put it in fancy pots.
No, sir. Got into the way of serving it in its own pot during the war, when things were scarce, and it's gone on like that ever since.
Neil murmured, That made it easier, of course.
What's more, said Sergeant Hay, Mr. Fortescue was the only one that took marmalade for breakfast, and Mr. Percival when he was at home. The others had jam or honey.
Neil nodded. Yes, he said. That made it very simple, didn't it? After a slight gap, the moving picture went on in his mind. It was the breakfast table now.
Rex Fortescue stretching out his hand for the marmalade pot, taking out a spoonful of marmalade and spreading it on his toast and butter. Easier, far easier that way than the risk and difficulty of insinuating it into his coffee cup. A foolproof method of administering the poison. And afterwards? Another gap, and a picture that was not quite so clear. The replacing of that pot of marmalade by another with exactly the same amount taken from it. And then an open window. A hand and an arm flinging out that pot into the shrubbery. Whose hand and arm? Whoever had tampered with that pot of marmalade need not have been present at the breakfast table. Inspector Neil said in a businesslike voice, "Well, we'll have, of course, to get this analysed. See if there are any traces of taxine. We can't jump to conclusions." "No, sir. There may be fingerprints, too." "Probably not the ones we want," said Inspector Neil gloomily. "There'll be Gladys's, of course, and Crump's and Fortescue's own. Then probably Mrs. Crump's, the grocer's assistant, and a few others. If anyone put taxine in here, they'd take care not to go playing about with their own fingers all over the pot. Anyway, as I say, we mustn't jump to conclusions. How do they order marmalade, and where is it kept?" The industrious Sergeant Hay had his answer pat for all these questions. "Marmalade and jams come in batches of 6 at a time. A new pot will be taken into the pantry when the old one was getting low." "That means," said Neil, "that it could have been tampered with several days before it was actually brought onto the breakfast table. And anyone who was in the house or had access to the house could have tampered with it." The term "access to the house" puzzled Sergeant Hay slightly. He did not see in what way his superior's mind was working. But Neil was postulating what seemed to him a logical assumption. If the marmalade had been tampered with beforehand, then surely that ruled out those persons who were actually at the breakfast table on the fatal morning, which opened up some interesting new possibilities. He planned in his mind interviews with various people, this time with rather a different angle of approach. He'd keep an open mind. He'd even consider seriously that old Miss What's-Her-Name's suggestions about the nursery rhyme, because there was no doubt that the nursery rhyme fitted in a rather startling way. It fitted with a point that had worried him from the beginning, the pocket full of rye. "Blackbirds?" murmured Inspector Neil to himself. Sergeant Hay stared.
"It's not blackberry jelly, sir," he said. "It's marmalade."
Inspector Neil went in search of Mary Dove. He found her in one of the bedrooms on the first floor, superintending Ellen, who was denuding the bed of what seemed to be clean sheets. A little pile of clean towels lay on a chair. Inspector Neil looked puzzled.
"Somebody coming to stay?" he asked.
Mary Dove smiled at him. In contrast to Ellen, who looked grim and truculent, Mary was her usual imperturbable self. "Actually," she said, "the opposite is the case." Neil looked inquiringly at her. "This is the guest room we had prepared for Mr. Gerald Wright."
"Gerald Wright? Who is he?"
"He's a friend of Miss Elaine Fortescue's." Mary's voice was carefully devoid of inflection.
"He was coming here. When?"
"I believe he arrived at the Golf Hotel the day after Mr. Fortescue's death."
"The day after?"
"So Miss Fortescue said."
Mary's voice was still impersonal.
"She told me she wanted him to come and stay in the house, so I had a room prepared. Now, after these other two tragedies, it seems more suitable that he should remain at the hotel."
"The Golf Hotel?"
"Yes."
"Quite," said Inspector Neil.
Ellen gathered up the sheets and towels and went out of the room. Mary Dove looked inquiringly at Neil. "You wanted to see me about something?"
Neil said pleasantly, "It's becoming important to get exact times very clearly stated. Members of the family all seem a little vague about time, perhaps understandably.
You, on the other hand, Miss Dove, I have found extremely accurate in your statements as to times.
Again, understandably.
Yes, perhaps. I must certainly congratulate you on the way you've kept this house going in spite of the, well, panic these last deaths must have caused.
He paused and then asked curiously, "How did you do it?"
He had realized astutely that the one chink in the armor of Mary Dove's inscrutability was her pleasure in her own efficiency. She unbent slightly now as she answered.
"The Crumps wanted to leave at once, of course."
"We couldn't have allowed that."
"I know. But I also told them that Mr. Percival Fortescue would be more likely to be, well, generous to those who had spared him inconvenience."
"And Ellen?"
"Ellen does not wish to leave."
"Ellen does not wish to leave," Neil repeated. "She has good nerves."
"She enjoys disasters," said Mary Dove. "Like Mrs. Percival, she finds in disaster a kind of pleasurable drama."
"Interesting. Do you think Mrs. Percival has enjoyed the tragedies?"
"No, of course not. That is going too far. I would merely say that it has enabled her to, well, stand up to them."
"And how have you yourself been affected, Miss Dove?"
Mary Dove shrugged her shoulders. "It has not been a pleasant experience," she said dryly. Inspector Neil felt again a longing to break down this cool young woman's defences, to find out what was really going on behind the careful and efficient understatement of her whole attitude. He merely said brusquely,
"Now, to recapitulate, times and places. The last time you saw Gladys Martin was in the hall before tea, and that was at 5:20?
"Yes, I told her to bring in tea."
"You yourself were coming from where?"
"From upstairs. I thought I had heard the telephone a few minutes before."
"Gladys presumably had answered the telephone."
"Yes, it was a wrong number. Someone who wanted the Baden Heath laundry."
"And that was the last time you saw her?"
"She brought the tea tray into the library about 10 minutes or so later."
"After that, Miss Elaine Fortescue came in."
"Yes, about 3 or 4 minutes later. Then I went up to tell Mrs. Percival tea was ready."
"Did you usually do that?"
"Oh, no. People came in to tea when they pleased, but Mrs. Fortescue asked where everybody was. I thought I heard Mrs. Percival coming down, but that was a mistake."
Neil interrupted. Here was something new.
"You mean you heard someone upstairs moving about?"
"Yes, at the head of the stairs, I thought. But no one came down, so I went up. Mrs. Percival was in her bedroom. She had just come in. She had been out for a walk."
"Out for a walk? I see. The time being then..."
"Oh, nearly 5 o'clock, I think."
"And Mr. Lancelot Fortescue arrived when?"
"A few minutes after I came downstairs again. I thought he had arrived earlier, but..."
Inspector Neil interrupted. "Why did you think he had arrived earlier?"
"Because I thought I had caught sight of him through the landing window."
"In the garden, you mean?"
"Yes. I caught a glimpse of someone through the yew hedge, and I thought it would probably be he."
"This was when you were coming down after telling Mrs. Percival Fortescue tea was ready?"
Mary corrected him. "No, not then. It was earlier, when I came down the first time."
Inspector Neil stared. "Are you sure about that, Miss Dove?"
"Yes, I'm perfectly sure. That's why I was surprised to see him, when he actually did ring the bell."
Inspector Neil shook his head. He kept his inner excitement out of his voice as he said, "It couldn't have been Lancelot Fortescue you saw. His train, which was due at 4:28, was 9 minutes late. He arrived at Baden Heath Station at 4:37. He had to wait a few minutes for a taxi. That train is always very full. It was actually nearly 4:45, 5 minutes after you had seen the man in the garden, when he left the station. And it is a 10 minutes' drive. He paid off the taxi at the gate here at about 5 minutes to 5 at the earliest.
No, it wasn't Lancelot Fortescue you saw.
I'm sure I did see someone.
Yes, you saw someone. It was getting dark. You couldn't have seen the man clearly.
Oh, no, I couldn't see his face or anything like that. Just his build, tall and slender. We were expecting Lancelot Fortescue, so I jumped to the conclusion that that's who it was.
He was going which way?
Along behind the yew hedge, towards the east side of the house.
There is a side door there. Is it kept locked?
Not until the house is locked up for the night.
Anyone could have come in by that side door without being observed by any of the household.
Mary Dove considered. I think so. Yes. She added quickly. You mean the person I heard later upstairs could have come in that way? Could have been hiding upstairs?
Something of the kind.
But who?
That remains to be seen. Thank you, Miss Dove.
As she turned to go away, Inspector Neil said, in a casual voice,
By the way, you can't tell me anything about blackbirds, I suppose.
For the first time, so it seemed, Mary Dove was taken aback. She turned back sharply. What did you say?
I was just asking you about blackbirds.
Do you mean...
Blackbirds, said Inspector Neil. He had on his most stupid expression.
You mean that silly business last summer? But surely that can't...
She broke off. Inspector Neil said pleasantly, There's been a bit of talk about it, but I was sure I'd get a clear account from you.
Mary Dove was her calm, practical self again. It must, I think, have been some silly, spiteful joke, she said. Four dead blackbirds were on Mr. Fortescue's desk in his study here. It was summer and the windows were open, and we rather thought it must have been the gardener's boy, though he insisted he'd never done anything of the kind. But they were actually blackbirds the gardener had shot, which had been hanging up by the fruit bushes.
And somebody had cut them down and put them on Mr. Fortescue's desk.
Yes.
Any sort of reason behind it? Any association with blackbirds?
Mary shook her head. I don't think so.
How did Mr. Fortescue take it? Was he annoyed?
Naturally he was annoyed.
But not upset in any way.
I really can't remember.
I see, said Inspector Neil.
He said no more. Mary Dove once more turned away, but this time, he thought, she went rather unwillingly, as though she would have liked to know more of what was in his mind. Ungratefully, all that Inspector Neil felt was annoyance with Miss Marple. She had suggested to him that there would be blackbirds, and sure enough, there the blackbirds were. Not 24 of them, that was true. What might be called a token consignment. That had been as long ago as last summer, and where it fitted in, Inspector Neil could not imagine. He was not going to let this blackbird bogey divert him from the logical and sober investigation of murder by a sane murderer for a sane reason. But he would be forced from now on to keep the crazier possibilities of the case in mind. Chapter 15.
I'm sorry, Miss Fortescue, to bother you again, but I want to be quite clear about this. As far as we know, you were the last person, or rather the last person but one, to see Mrs. Fortescue alive. It was about 5:20 when you left the library.
About then, said Elaine. I can't say exactly. She added defensively. One doesn't look at clocks the whole time.
No, of course not. During the time that you were alone with Mrs. Fortescue, after the others had left, what did you talk about?
Does it matter what we talked about?
Probably not, said Inspector Neil. But it might give me some clue as to what was in Mrs. Fortescue's mind.
You mean you think she might have done it herself?
Inspector Neil noticed the brightening of her face.
It would certainly be a very convenient solution as far as the family was concerned. Inspector Neil did not think it was true for a moment. Adele Fortescue was not, to his mind, a suicidal type. Even if she had poisoned her husband and was convinced the crime was about to be brought home to her, she would not, he thought, have ever thought of killing herself. She would have been optimistically sure that even if she were tried for murder, she would be sure to be acquitted. He was not, however, averse to Elaine Fortescue's entertaining the hypothesis. He said, therefore, quite truthfully, "There's a possibility of it at least, Miss Fortescue. Now, perhaps you'll tell me just what your conversation was about?"
"Well, it was really about my affairs," Elaine hesitated.
"Your affairs being..." He paused questioningly with a genial expression.
"A friend of mine had just arrived in the neighbourhood, and I was asking Adele if she would have any objection to my asking him to stay here at the house."
"Ah, and who is this friend?"
"It's Mr. Gerald Wright. He's a schoolmaster. He's staying at the Golf Hotel."
"A very close friend, perhaps." Inspector Neil gave an avuncular beam which added at least 15 years to his age. "We may expect an interesting announcement shortly, perhaps?" He felt almost compunction as he saw the awkward gesture of the girl's hand and the flush on her face. She was in love with the fellow, all right.
We're not actually engaged, and of course we couldn't have it announced just now, but, well, yes, I think we do. I mean, we are going to get married."
"Congratulations," said Inspector Neil pleasantly. "Mr. Wright is staying at the Golf Hotel, isn't he? How long has he been there?"
"I wired him when Father died."
"And he came at once. I see," said Inspector Neil. He used this favourite phrase of his in a friendly and reassuring way. "What did Mrs. Fortescue say when you asked her about his coming here?"
"Oh, she said, all right, I could have anybody I pleased."
"She was nice about it, then?"
"Not exactly nice. I mean, she said..."
"Yes, what else did she say?" Again Elaine flushed.
"Oh, something stupid about my being able to do a lot better for myself now. It was the sort of thing Adele would say."
"Ah, well," said Inspector Neil soothingly, "relations say these sort of things."
"Yes, yes, they do. But people often find it difficult to appreciate Gerald properly. He's an intellectual, you see, and he's got a lot of unconventional and progressive ideas that people don't like."
"That's why he didn't get on with your father?" Elaine flushed hotly.
"Father was very prejudiced and unjust. He hurt Gerald's feelings. In fact, Gerald was so upset by my father's attitude that he went off, and I didn't hear from him for weeks."
"And probably wouldn't have heard from him now if your father hadn't died and left you a packet of money," Inspector Neil thought. Aloud, he said, "Was there any more conversation between you and Mrs. Fortescue?"
No, I didn't think so."
"And that was about 5:25, and Mrs. Fortescue was found dead at 6:05. You didn't return to the room during that half hour?"
"No."
"What were you doing?"
I went out for a short walk."
"To the Golf Hotel?"
Well, yes. But Gerald wasn't in."
Inspector Neil said, "I see," again, but this time with a rather dismissive effect. Elaine Fortescue got up and said,
"Is that all?"
"That's all. Thank you, Miss Fortescue." As she got up to go, Neil said casually, "You can't tell me anything about blackbirds, can you?" She stared at him.
"Blackbirds? You mean the ones in the pie?"
"They would be in the pie," the inspector thought to himself. He merely said, "When was this?"
"Oh, 3 or 4 months ago. And there were some on Father's desk, too. He was furious."
"Furious, was he? Did he ask a lot of questions?"
"Yes, of course, but we couldn't find out who put them there."
"Have you any idea why he was so angry?"
"Well, it was rather a horrid thing to do, wasn't it?"
Neil looked thoughtfully at her, but he did not see any signs of evasion in her face. He said, "Oh, just one more thing, Miss Fortescue. Do you know if your stepmother made a will at any time?" Elaine shook her head.
"I've no idea. I suppose so. People usually do, don't they?"
"They should do, but it doesn't always follow. Have you made a will yourself, Miss Fortescue?"
"No, no, I haven't. Up to now, I haven't had anything to leave. Now, of course..."
He saw the realization of the changed position come into her eyes. "Yes," he said. £50,000 is quite a responsibility. It changes a lot of things, Miss Fortescue." For some minutes after Elaine Fortescue left the room, Inspector Neil sat staring in front of him thoughtfully. He had indeed new food for thought. Mary Dove's statement that she had seen a man in the garden at approximately 4:35 opened up certain new possibilities. That is, of course, if Mary Dove was speaking the truth. It was never Inspector Neil's habit to assume that anyone was speaking the truth, but examine her statement as he might, he could see no real reason why she should have lied. He was inclined to think that Mary Dove was speaking the truth when she spoke of having seen a man in the garden. It was quite clear that that man could not have been Lancelot Fortescue, although her reason for assuming that it was he was quite natural under the circumstances. It had not been Lancelot Fortescue, but it had been a man about the height and build of Lancelot Fortescue. And if there had been a man in the garden at that particular time, moreover, a man moving furtively, as it seemed, to judge from the way he'd crept behind the yew hedges, then that certainly opened up a line of thought. Added to this statement of hers, there had been the further statement that she had heard someone moving about upstairs. That, in its turn, tied up with something else. The small piece of mud he had found on the floor of Adèle Fortescue's boudoir. Inspector Neil's mind dwelt on the small, dainty desk in that room. Pretty little sham antique, with a rather obvious secret drawer in it. There had been three letters in that drawer, letters written by Vivian Dubois to Adèle Fortescue. A great many love letters of one kind or another had passed through Inspector Neil's hands in the course of his career. He was acquainted with passionate letters, foolish letters, sentimental letters, and nagging letters. There had also been cautious letters. Inspector Neil was inclined to classify these three as of the latter kind. Even if read in the divorce court, they could pass as inspired by a merely platonic friendship. Though in this case, platonic friendship my foot, thought the inspector, inelegantly. Neil, when he had found the letters, had sent them up at once to the Yard, since, at that time, the main question was whether the public prosecutor's office thought that there was sufficient evidence to proceed with the case against Adèle Fortescue, or Adèle Fortescue and Vivian Dubois together. Everything had pointed towards Rex Fortescue having been poisoned by his wife, with or without her lover's connivance. These letters, though cautious, made it fairly clear that Vivian Dubois was her lover. But there had not been in the wording, so far as Inspector Neil could see, any signs of incitement to crime. There might have been incitement of a spoken kind, but Vivian Dubois would be far too cautious to put anything of that kind down on paper. Inspector Neil surmised accurately that Vivian Dubois had asked Adèle Fortescue to destroy his letters, and that Adèle Fortescue had told him she had done so. Well, now they had two more deaths on their hands, and that meant, or should mean, that Adèle Fortescue had not killed her husband. Unless, that is, Inspector Neil considered a new hypothesis. Adèle Fortescue had wanted to marry Vivian Dubois, and Vivian Dubois had wanted not Adèle Fortescue, but Adèle Fortescue's £100,000, which would come to her on the death of her husband.
He had assumed, perhaps, that Rex Fortescue's death would be put down to natural causes, some kind of seizure or stroke. After all, everybody seemed to be worried over Rex Fortescue's health during the last year. Parenthetically, Inspector Neil said to himself that he must look into that question. He had a subconscious feeling that it might be important in some way. To continue, Rex Fortescue's death had not gone according to plan. It had been diagnosed without loss of time as poisoning, and the correct poison named. Supposing that Adele Fortescue and Vivien Dubois had been guilty, what state would they be in then? Vivien Dubois would have been scared, and Adele Fortescue would have lost her head. She might have done or said foolish things. She might have rung up Dubois on the telephone, talking indiscreetly in a way that he would have realised might have been overheard in Yew Tree Lodge. What would Vivien Dubois have done next? It was early as yet to try and answer that question, but Inspector Neil proposed very shortly to make inquiries at the Golf Hotel as to whether Dubois had been in or out of the hotel between the hours of 4:15 and 6 o'clock. Vivien Dubois was tall and dark, like Lance Fortescue. He might have slipped through the garden to the side door, made his way upstairs, and then what? Look for the letters and found them gone? Waited there perhaps till the coast was clear, then come down into the library when tea was over and Adele Fortescue was alone? But all this was going too fast. Neil had questioned Mary Dove and Elaine Fortescue. He must see now what Percival Fortescue's wife had to say.